When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to look at the process of what is euphemistically called liberation in China in 1949, the takeover of China by the Communist Party, the People's Liberation Army, the beginnings of communist rule in 1949, obviously start at the end of, or the successful conclusion by the communists of the Chinese Civil War that had been raging on and off since 1927, and the departure by Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang to Taiwan. Anybody who harbours any notions that there was some Manichaean good and evil battle happening between the poor benighted nationalists and the wicked communists, again, needs to kind of revisit this one and examine what Chiang did when arriving in Taiwan. One of his first acts was to execute 30,000 dissidents and potential troublemakers. So it is entirely possible to suggest that perhaps had Chiang been successful in the Civil War, some of the ideological excesses of the nationalists wouldn't have been quite the same. I can't imagine there being a Chiang-led great leap forward. But much of the corruption and violence and cruelty would no doubt have played out. So today I'm going to look at The Tragedy of Liberation by Frank Dakota. Frank Dakota's trilogy of Mao, from The Tragedy of Liberation, Mao's Famine, and The Cultural Revolution, A People's History, unrelentingly critical of Mao, and presents Mao and Maoism as a vast human catastrophe for China. When totting up The Great Leap Forward, The Cultural Revolution, The Hundred Flowers Campaign, The Anti-Rightist Campaigns, The Anti-Landlord Campaigns, the creation of labour camps across China and re-education and all the works, one can't help but agree. There seems to be very little in the Mao era that balances out such enormous suffering. So Frank Dakota writes about the actual communist takeover. He writes, "Liberation began with fanfare. Communist rule in every important town was inaugurated with a carefully choreographed procession. Soldiers invariably opened the parade, followed by a lorry bearing a huge portrait of Mao Zedong. Dance troops dressed in blue, red and green dresses and silk scarves waving red flags and wearing white towel turbans performed the traditional harvest dance, the rice sprout song or yangi, swaying their bodies to the music played by waist drums, heavy gongs and trumpets. Fluid dance movements were supposed to celebrate peasants in daily activities such as sowing grain or carrying water on shoulder poles. Here, it seemed, was a form of art by the people, for the people, to be seen in every procession and at every meeting. Even in the north, where the rice sprout song was popular, ordinary farmers would have been puzzled by the way the troops performed the folk dance. Some of the melodies no longer had anything to do with local folk song, but were borrowed instead from the Soviet army. The traditional lyrics, like folk plays everywhere around the world, were often bawdy and downright obscene, telling stories of love and betrayal. But now they celebrated the abolition of unequal treaties and the victory of the People's Liberation Army. The traditionally complex dance steps had been simplified into three or four basic movements. A cast of traditional characters from fortune tellers and henpecked husbands to priests, squires and immortals were replaced by workers, soldiers and peasants. But in parts of China, traditional rice sprout songs meant little to ordinary people. In Xi'an, spectators were unable to identify any of the characters in the parade as they had nothing to do with local opera. The only thing that was the same was the ear-splitting banging of the gongs and drums, which reverberated throughout the city so often that most days seemed like New Year's, an audible sign that times had changed. Many onlookers nonetheless enjoyed the festivities and as the celebratory sounds announced the end of the war. So for a brief moment, there are a considerable number of Chinese people who were simply relieved that conflict was over. There were those who had an inkling about what the communists had in mind, who were very, very worried about what would follow. But as in most scenarios, there was a sense of jubilation that the fighting had stopped, irrespective of which side had won. But the metaphor of the folk song is an interesting one. It's a kind of a motif, really, for Maoist thinking of co-opting peasant life and peasant culture and the complex and rich folk culture of China and imposing upon it a variation of Marxist-Leninism where the principal classes of soldiers, workers and peasants are those that are the determinant drivers of history. In folklore, those that shape the material world are, as is said, peasants and spirits and cuckolded husbands and local priests and the kind of the characters of these kinds of dramas. And a new drama, one based on an ideology that was entirely alien to China, was about to play out for the next three decades. So there were political rallies of a much bigger scale in places like Beijing and Shanghai. On the 6th of July, for example, tanks rumbled along the Nanjing Road through Shanghai. And these were followed by workers chanting and thrusting their fists in the air. And the workers were sent by lorry to establishments such as the Shell Oil Company, holding banners and placards denouncing capitalist exploitation. However, at this stage of things, it all seems relatively tame. There seems to be a lot of symbolism, a lot of metaphor, but not a great deal of action. But this would change. On October the 1st, Mao declared the establishment of the Central People's Government in a rally at Tiananmen Square in front of 300,000 people. And the picture, once again, Mao tries to give is one of relative moderation. Mao appears alongside various kind of fellow traveller figures, for example, Song Qingling, who was the sister-in-law of Chiang Kai-shek, but who had drifted towards the communists, and had been was there in a kind of a quite a symbolic role. So, but Mao spoke to the audience. He spoke in terms of the establishment of a democratic China, though his notion of democracy was straight out of the kind of the Stalin playbook of it would be a China for peasants and workers, and that is a democracy in itself, one that doesn't really involve elections or voting. The central government of the People's Republic of China is established, he proclaimed. There were onlookers who were deeply emotional and who wept with joy to hear these words. And this was followed by a military rally and the same kind of almost circus-like theatrics that had been seen previously, but of course that was mentioned previously, but of course kind of co-opted into the telling of the kind of the Marxist-Leninist Maoist story. The force behind the Maoist takeover was the People's Liberation Army. The People's Liberation Army was demographically almost exclusively under the age of 25. These were young people who had fought wars, who had been entirely brutalised by the process, who had been subject to indoctrination, whose overall levels of education were such that the first written material they had probably ever come in contact with had been Maoist. And so their worldview was simple, harsh, and the outcome that they had been fighting for had now arrived. They were in many communities seen as a frightening and alien group. And bear in mind that China is this incredibly diverse, incredibly rich social landscape of everybody from the poorest peasants to small landowners, wealthy peasants, artisans and bourgeois types, many of whom found the ideology that had been imposed upon them entirely alien, along with its chief enforcers, the People's Liberation Army, people with whom they had very little connection or understanding of. Frank Dakota writes, After the celebrations came the police. They were less friendly than the soldiers. They did the rounds, inviting themselves into people's homes, searching for forbidden items, from weapons to radios. The policeman who harassed Kang Zhengguo's family in Jian had a shabby uniform and a heavy northern Shaanxi accent. We always served him tea in the parlour, but he seemed unaccustomed to smooth cedar chairs, and after sitting for a while, he would shift to a squatting position right on his chair without even taking off his shoes. He was interested in the family's vacuum tube radio. The police suspected that the device was used to send wireless telegrams rather than receive broadcasts. The head of the Kang household was repeatedly summoned to the police station for questioning. Exasperated, he eventually surrendered the device. All over China, the police visited people suspected of being sympathetic to the old regime. In big cities like Beijing, Shanghai and Wuhan, special teams trained to take over public security arrived within days of liberation.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
After briefing by underground members of the Communist Party, they moved into precinct stations and police headquarters and ordered everyone to stay at their posts. General Chen Yi, now the new mayor of Shanghai, replaced his peaked cap with a dark beret, exhorting the police force in a 3-hour meeting, an unlit cigarette dangling from his mouth. They should reform themselves and at the same time carry on their work without undue anxieties, he explained. Communists had little choice but to ask former government servants and puppet policemen to stay on. In each department, the post office, the city hall, the police headquarters, some of the top officials of the old regime slipped away while a few new faces appeared. So that is fascinating and revealing in itself on a number of levels. Firstly, the Communist Party had a strategy planned for the assumption of power. They had a set of party activists and enforcers that would establish themselves in towns and cities to take over the apparatus of government and to start to politicise it, to start to Maoify it, if you will. And this meant that they could then interact with the agents and informers and sleepers that the party had had on the ground for many years, who had been making lists of suspect bourgeois types, class enemies. So even during the years where it appeared that Mao was losing the civil war, he was planning ahead for eventual victory and what that would look like. And this really taps into Marxist-Leninist and Maoist thinking of the idea that the civil war is never really won, that once you defeat the enemy on the battlefield, you have to fight a new kind of war, and that's a class war. You retain the control of the apparatuses of state, the police, the army. You don't wind up in some kind of Trotskyist, quasi-anarchist fantasy that was drifting around just after the Russian Revolution. The state could be dissolved. Far from it. In Lenin's State and Revolution, he said that the state would now be essential. You have to hang on to it because it's going to wage the next phase of class warfare, and that is rooting out all the nasty bourgeois types who will eventually undo your revolution and getting rid of them. The other thing that is fascinating on that basis is the extent to which Mao and his regime were forced to allowed themselves to compromise by allowing chief civil servants to stay behind. Now, there's an argument to say that a regime like Mao's in a country the size of China's has no choice. One can't simply do a clean sweep in a country of hundreds of millions of individuals and get rid of the entire bureaucracy, civil service, and the people that make everything from the electricity substations continue operating to the economic system of function or the operating of municipal facilities function. You can't simply get rid of all of those. Instead, what one does is you have to play the long game. You find those that are willing to cooperate at first. You might decide later on that even if they're willing to cooperate, you still don't quite believe that they are they are as loyal as they say they are, and eventually get rid of them. Or you simply crowd them with party cadres, with political commissars, to make sure that their work is following specific ideological lines. So one primary source from the era states, "The typical bureaucrat of the regime, in his blue or khaki uniform, like a soldier's, topped by a cloth cap, which he often wears even in the office, resembles a Soviet commissar much more than a Chinese official. He lives frugally, he is a poor man, and is clothed, fed, and housed by the party. His tobacco and soap are given to him on the official ration, and he hardly earns enough in a month to buy himself a pair of shoddy sandals. He sleeps on the floor and is in requisitioned European buildings. He rejects the soft mattress that would prevent him from sleeping. He is distant with strangers, and apart from those few men who are appointed to deal with foreign relations, he is inaccessible. He insists that other Chinese speak to him in the Peking tongue, now more than ever the official language of the whole country, and not in the local dialect of Shanghai or elsewhere." So that is the kind of individual who was now appointed to oversee the transition to the new kind of government. That was, in the words of Maoist party cadres, the ideal kind of bureaucrat. Obviously, this would present a problem for the future, and this would present the kind of the basis of future purges, that those sorts of self-denying, ascetic martyrs for the revolution, people who basically lived in poverty and slept on floors and were public administrators by day and party activists by night and simply lived and breathed for the revolution, they are very, very few and far between, because basically human beings aren't like that, or very, very few human beings are like that. But the that way of describing the individual was drawn straight out of the 19th century Russian revolutionary intelligentsia tradition. Books like What is to Be, Chernyshevsky's What is to Be Done, which presented the romanticised version of the revolutionary as somebody who essentially sleeps on a bed of nails to toughen themselves endlessly with privation for the revolutionary struggle to come. Someone whose view of themselves as an individual is that the individual is irrelevant, and the greater entity of the revolution itself is the only thing that actually matters. So government employees from the old nationalist regime continue to do most of the work. The nationalist police had begun registering households in 1945 and handing out identity cards to cities under their control, which had meant that the infrastructure of control already existed. People's names and details and all sorts of valuable information about them existed in card file indexes. And so now, as far as the communists were concerned, the regime was able to identify people more easily as being suspect classes, and they could decry some individuals as being dangerous, and controlled the amount of food they had access to. Food rationing cards were given to the head of each household, and that person could also be made responsible for reporting any information about the household that the authorities needed to know. So, once again, if you look at the Bolshevik regime in 1918, if you look at the period 1945-48 in Eastern Europe, and the Maoist revolution, control of food is a key way in which communist authorities establish their control of entire societies. Endless rationing and privation were ways in which people had few other options than to obey the party. This led to a dramatic increase in bureaucratism, something that dissident aspects of both the Soviet and the Maoist regimes both decried in both Russia and in China. But it also meant that the state could penetrate homes and houses and lives and individuals in ways that it had never been possible beforehand. So household registration was one level of control. But the next was individual class identification. So class labels would be given to individuals, which would include their family background, occupation, and individual status. There were about 60 of these labels. They're called the Cheng Fen, which would divide then down into broader class categories. These would be ranked as good, middle, and bad on the basis of their presumed loyalty towards the revolution. For example, good classes would include revolutionary cadres, revolutionary soldiers, revolutionary martyrs, industrial workers, and poor and lower middle peasants. Middle classes would be the petty bourgeoisie, small shopkeepers and things like that, the middle peasants, and the intellectuals and professionals. They might still be useful. Bad classes were landlords, rich peasants, and capitalists. And these class designations, these class groupings, would soon be simplified into two opposites, red or black, friend or foe. So these would determine the fates of individuals for the rest of their lives. And children would inherit the status of their parents. Once again, very, very reminiscent of Stalinist Russia as the label of former people or kulak could haunt a person for the rest of their lives and determine their access to jobs, housing, food, or the possibility of them being endlessly arrested. So that what we've talked about there this morning is just the very, very beginnings of the Maoist takeover of China. And I'll try to return to this in a little while and look at some of the kind of the deeper inroads that the Maoist regime makes into the lives of ordinary people. Thanks for listening, and remember, if you can support us via Patreon, that's always appreciated. All the best. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.